Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 50 million Americans were looking forward to peaceful family dinners starting next week, but with just days to go before its October 1st implementation, the federal government's Do Not Call program, allowing citizens to shut out telemarketers, has been thrown for a loop. There's a telemarketing tug of war going on between the courts and Congress, a battle over your privacy, telemarketing jobs, and the constitutionally guaranteed freedom of speech, even telemarketer speech. Tonight on Point, turn off the ringer, unplug the phone. We're looking at the telemarketer's last stand. We begin tonight with the latest from Washington. Caroline Mayer is a staff writer for the Washington Post. She's been following the Do Not Call list story as it unfolds and joins us live. Caroline Mayer, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
So what's the latest? It is really hard to make it out through all these news reports. Is the list going to be in effect? Are the calls to be blocked starting October 1st, next Wednesday, or not?
No. The FTC put out a notice today that said that telemarketers no longer have to comply with the rule, although they hope that they will, and they're going to do everything that they can sort of to strong-arm them, but that they don't officially have to comply.
So no peace guaranteed at this point for those 50 million-plus Americans who have signed up?
Well, yes and no. There is no peace. On the other hand, there are several companies that are saying that they are going to do the list, at least keep the follow it for the initially.
They'd be honoring it, that is, if people said they don't want calls.
That's right. They've already AT&T and MCI and some of the other big companies have already cleaned their list out in preparation for October 1st. And so they said that at least initially they're going to start doing that. And one of the big associations of the telemarketers has advised their members to please go ahead because people who don't want calls don't want calls, so it's a waste of their time.
On the other hand, you quote the executive director of the American Teleservices
right.
Association, Tim Searcy, saying after the Denver ruling, how cool is this?
He's very excited about it, and it was actually sort of fun to hear that excitement because most people are very guarded in whatever they say. But having said that, he is recommending to his members that they don't adhere to the list, that the list was declared unconstitutional. So even if they were to voluntarily adhere to it, that it's unconstitutional, and that sort of defeats the whole purpose of challenging.
So keep right on dialing. At this point, Caroline, do you feel that the telemarketing industry feels that it might win, that it might turn back this whole big effort?
Absolutely. The tide has turned from the government feeling very cocky to the telemarketers just on top of thin air.
And the thing that has them feeling so confident, I'm guessing, is not the argument over whether or not the FTC has the authority to do this, but rather is the Denver ruling that there's something unconstitutional here.
That's the harder ruling to deal with. The first court ruling that came out just said the FTC didn't have authority, and Congress, as we saw yesterday, moved with lightning speed and overturned that.
No kidding. You say that the quickest they've ever moved in circumstances other than war and financial meltdown.
That's exactly what I could find out from congressional historians.
Incredible.
That was pretty amazing. So,
but Congress protected that flank, but this issue of constitutionality is a much more serious threat.
It's harder to deal with, and it's harder to deal with partly also because the judge found it was unconstitutional because the way the plan was going to go into effect, charitable organizations could still call you, but companies like long distance and magazines and newspaper publishers couldn't. And he found that very unfair and unconstitutional.
That is, commercial, come-ons were off the table, but political calls, charitable nonprofit calls, and telephone surveys like the Gallup poll, all of those could still go ahead.
Right. And he only ruled on the charitable part. But the fact of the matter is that politicians were also exempt, and so for Congress to come and do something could affect and probably would affect their pocketbooks. So it's really unclear how willing and quick Congress is going to be able to come in there.
Oh, you're saying this time, if Congress comes to the defense of the Do Not Call list, they may be cutting off their own telephone access to potential donors?
Well, that's one idea. I don't know how they're going to come out and try to solve the unconstitutionality issue. But if they were to say, okay, apply the Do Not Call list to everybody, that would apply to them.
That could really slow down the nation's Congress, one imagines.
I can't imagine that would move as quickly. In fact, I've sort of laughed because the first day that the Congress heard about the first judge's ruling, I had more phone calls from congressmen that I should know about the bills that were being introduced. I must have had at least a dozen.
We're on top of this. We're fighting for our constituents.
Absolutely. I have had not one single phone call today. Now, admittedly, Congress is out of session, but I still have not had one single phone call from anyone voluntarily telling me that they're acting.
Carolyn Mayer, give us a bit of a further sense of what the judge was saying. Saying, if you put a limit on commercial speech, that is the telemarketer's commercial call, you've got to put it on everyone?
Well, he was saying that, but what he was saying is by saying you can let one kind of business in, the charities, and not another, that basically the FTC was sort of telling consumers what they could and couldn't listen to, and mm-hmm. that was therefore unfair.
Even though these were consumers who were putting their own hands up and voluntarily saying, please put my name on the do not call list.
Because they could still get calls from charitable contributions, charitable organizations. At least that was his argument.
Mm-hmm. Carolyn, can you give us a sense of this industry? The telemarketing associations have been putting out some very big numbers about the financial chaos that would ensue. They're saying 2 million jobs would be lost, $275 billion industry if this do not call list goes into effect. Are those numbers seen as credible?
I think not. And I think even some of the telemarketing people admit that. The 2 million I was told yesterday by one telemarketing official was included everyone, even people who processed the orders when you bought something from a Lands' End or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's probably hyped and not quite accurate, but
there's still a lot of jobs out there and a lot of money. It is a big industry, I guess.
There are a lot of jobs, and unfortunately, the jobs are going to people who are the least skilled and probably need them the most.
You quote, or I've seen quoted, again, Tim Searcy saying that 5% of teleservices employees are physically disabled, 30% have been on welfare or public
right.
assistance, more than 60% are minorities. The federal Do Not Call list is not the only one. There are state lists out there, two or three dozen. How many at this point?
There are, I think, 27 that are now in effect right now. And the problem, though, with this ruling is that if it's unconstitutional nationally on the grounds of their exemptions, it's going to be unconstitutional in the states, too, because the states have even more exemptions than the national Do Not Call list.
So this could actually come back, I mean, conceivably, and take all the bars off again.
Absolutely. The FTC said that today. The state's attorney generals I talked to said that today. And both of the key telemarketing associations also said that they had to consider that in light of this judge's decision.
Just when everybody thought it was safe to sit down for dinner, what are the next steps to watch here, Caroline?
Well, I think, first of all, the court decision to see what happens. Obviously, the FTC has appealed, and we'll see what happens there. We'll see what comes out with the FTC, how they can figure out what to do to help people. I mean, Americans are irate. They clearly don't want telemarketing calls. 50 million numbers on this list is a lot of numbers.
It is a lot.
Congress hears that, and they're going to hear it from their constituents. So I'm not quite sure where to watch. It's definitely the three branches of government in action here, and I'm not sure who's going to move first and what's going to happen.
What a show it's going to be, and everybody watching. You quote Senator Charles Schumer saying the court decision was goofy. 50 million people can't be all wrong.
No matter which court decision, I think he would say that, although that was before the unconstitutional decision mm-hmm. yesterday. That's mm-hmm. right. There are a lot of people up in arms about this, and so it'll be interesting to see how this plays out.
Well, we're going to dig into the legal side of it tonight. Caroline Mayer, thanks so much for being with us. I know you've got a story to write. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Caroline Mayer is a staff writer for The Washington Post. She spoke with us from Washington. We're talking tonight about the uncertain fate of the National Do Not Call Registry. Were you one of the 50 million Americans who signed up for the telemarketing Do Not Disturb list? And what deserves greater protection, your privacy or a telemarketer's freedom of speech? And if commercial telemarketers are prohibited from calling, should the same go for political and nonprofit groups for charities? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Naperville, Illinois, is Robert Bullmash, president and founder of Private Citizen, a consumer advocacy group that lobbies to protect individuals' privacy from direct marketing onslaughts. Good evening and welcome, Robert Bullmash.
Good evening. Glad to be with you.
Thanks very much for joining us. What do you make of this whole picture? You must have been about to pop a cork there at Private Citizen, and now the courts are saying, hold on.
Well, This constitutional right of free speech issue, which was brought to the fore by the Denver court, is a genuine issue. In my sense of it, someone else's right of free speech should not necessarily be governed by the content of that speech.
And that's what the court's saying, that when you discriminate between different kinds of calls, then you're looking at the content of the speech, and you cannot constitutionally discriminate on content.
Exactly. I think if the FTC and 10 years ago when the FCC passed its regulations would have given us a national do not call list that allowed us to opt out of various types of calls, sales, survey, fundraising, and political calls, then we could have opted out from any one of those four or all.
So you're saying the problem is it wasn't a bold enough plan in the first place.
Oh, back in 1991 when the FCC had an opportunity to create a national do not call list, which Congress gave the FCC, said, you can do this if you want. The FCC instead created a company-specific do not call list that consumers had to individually deliver to telemarketing firms when they called.
You were on three FTC panels that looked at all this. What was the conversation like? Why didn't the FTC just pull the trigger on the whole waterfront there?
Because everybody is so wrapped up with First Amendment issues on the right of free speech, and there's tests on how you can regulate free speech. And one is, of course, the Central Hudson test, which says essentially the speech has to the regulation has to materially go to the point that the legislation wants it to go to, in other words, protect the privacy of the home and so on and so forth. But since commercial speech has less protection than non-commercial speech, they were only willing to regulate non-commercial speech. In my view, I'm sorry, they were only willing to regulate commercial speech. But in my view, there's another part to the First Amendment, and that's our right of free association. And if we are able to exercise our right to freely associate, and the corollary of that right, our right to freely not associate with someone, that right must exist in our homes. And if it doesn't exist in our homes, it doesn't exist anywhere. And our right to freely not be bothered by junk phone callers, whether it's sales, survey, fundraising, or political.
You know, when I hear telemarketing, I free associate, and it brings to mind a lot of disrupted dinners. Robert Bulmash, what's the picture of intrusion that has got Americans so up in arms over this and 50 million putting their hands up saying, keep this off my telephone?
Well, Private Citizen's been around for 15 years, and over those 15 years, you can imagine I've received tens of thousands of calls from consumers describing what's going on. Some of the more dramatic ones are women and families, I should say, who receive 17 to 20 calls a day.
Seriously?
Yes. Another, those kinds of, that occurrence happens where there is a high mobility rate and money, such as college towns where professors are in and out all the time. There's a transient population, and bang, they're hit with everything.
Okay.
Then there was one woman who I talked to who lived in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. She was getting hang-up calls because of a telemarketer's predictive dialer that was calling her and hanging up because they didn't have a telemarketer to talk to her at that point.
So that's what happens when the phone rings, you go, and there's a buzz and nobody there.
Exactly.
It may be that.
Right.
It's a machine doing the business and no one there to pick up at the other end.
Right. What we did was I checked through who was calling. I found out it was a telemarketer using a predictive dialer that was calling and hanging up on her. And when that happened, she got a settlement out of the outfit. But she had to put bars on her window and install a burglar alarm.
Why?
And quit her job as a nurse in order to protect her children. She thought she was being stalked.
Oh, she had thought because of all the calls
that
came through.
All the hang-up calls. She didn't know where they were coming from. And this is the nature of the telenuisance industry.
People talk about, the industry talks about the cost to the industry of it being shut down. Is there a cost to the country from the calls themselves?
Oh, yes. Think of all the wasted time. Running to the phone. I mean, people aren't even answering their phones now. They're letting answering machines take the calls. And when that happens, say if someone, a genuine friend or an associate calls you, they have to pay for a call that's going to hit an answering machine and wait for the answering machine greeting to end and then place their message on it. That takes, you know, that takes segments of minutes, if not a minute, and that has to be paid for. The economy is paying for the telenuisance industry already.
And I have to say, I have seen that, a real change in social behavior where people do not necessarily answer the phone when it rings anymore.
Exactly.
You're drawing a line right back from that to telemarketing. Of course, the whole do not call list is on the ropes tonight. No one knows how this is going to work out. We're talking tonight about the fate of the federal Do Not Call list and the future of telemarketing and the peace of your family dinner hour. You can join the conversation. Are you one of the 50 million Americans who have already signed up for the federal Do Not Disturb sign? Is the telemarketing problem really a nightmare? Is it overblown? And is stopping the telemarketers suppressing free speech or saving your sanity? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the fate of the federal Do Not Call list, the future of telemarketing, and maybe the peace of your family dinner hour. You can join the conversation tonight. Is stopping the telemarketers suppressing free speech? Is it unconstitutional in your mind? And is it fair to clamp down on commercial speech and leave the phones open for political and charitable fundraising? Do you care if the telemarketing industry loses jobs, or could you care less? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've been on the phone tonight from Naperville, Illinois, with Robert Bullmash. He's president and founder of Private Citizen. It's a consumer advocacy group that lobbies to protect individuals' privacy from direct marketing practices. We're joined now from Highland Park, Illinois, by Martin Reddish. He's a professor of law and public policy at Northwestern University. He's filed a statement with the FTC on behalf of telemarketing firms. He's author of Money Talks, Speech, Economic Power and the Values of Democracy. Good evening and welcome, Martin Reddish.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And with us from Seattle, Washington, Anita Ramasastri. She's assistant law professor at the University of Washington and associate director of the Scheidler Center for Law, Commerce, and Technology at the University of Washington. Good evening and welcome, Anita Ramasastri.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for being with us. Martin Reddish, to you first. You have stood up on behalf of the telemarketing industry as a legal mind and defended their interests. What's the argument you make?
Well, I should say when I filed my statement, the FTC's regulations were even far narrower than they are. They left out everything the FTC couldn't reach, including telecommunications telemarketing or insurance telemarketing. Since that time, the FCC has gotten into the picture. So the only thing now that's left out are charitable, nonprofit regulations. But it's actually a really very simple matter of Supreme Court doctrine. And Judge Nottingham, whom I don't know but wrote an excellent opinion.
Edward Nottingham, the U.S. District Judge in Denver.
Right. He just hit it right on the nose. There's a Supreme Court case that is smack dab on point. And unless and until the Supreme Court changes things, that's the way it's going to be. You know, after Bush versus Gore, I wouldn't want to predict what the Supreme Court's going to do. But under current doctrine, the city of Cincinnati versus Discovery Network in 1993 says quite expressly that government cannot suppress commercial speech, but simultaneously leave unregulated non-commercial speech that gives rise to the exact same danger. The case involved the attempt by Cincinnati to beautify its streets by removing newspaper racks.
Okay.
And they only removed commercial newspaper racks and didn't remove regular newspaper racks. And the Supreme Court says the same aesthetic danger or harm is caused by the non-commercial newspaper rack.
And you're saying newspaper racks or telemarketing calls, it's all the same principle?
Oh, sure, right. I mean, that wouldn't make any difference. Here, unless the government can show somehow that the invasion of privacy from the non-profit calls is less of a harm or a threat than the harm from profit-making calls.
But, of course, Nottingham wrote, he said, there is no doubt that unwanted calls seeking charitable contributions are as invasive to the privacy of someone sitting down to dinner at home as unwanted calls from commercial telemarketers. Anita Ramasastri, what's your response to that? Is this an open and shut case? Does Martin Reddish have it right? Is this list headed for the scrap heap?
He might have it right. When I first read the newspaper articles, I'll admit, and I'm not a constitutional law professor, but a commercial one that advocates for consumers in many contexts, you know, I thought, yes, this case must be wrongly decided, and read it, and I think it's a closer call. I'd first say that what's surprising about this case is I think that the court seems to be ruling that, in fact, if you did have a broader do not call registry that applied to all kinds of volume calls, that would be constitutional. So again, I think, you know, there is a broader solution. Whether it's politically feasible is a different question.
So to go for a broader now, list, but then you'll have all the political fundraisers and the charities saying, hey, this is our avenue to funds.
Right, right. So I'm saying, you know, whether that'll ever happen, but theoretically that's something that is permissible and would make consumers happy. On the second issue, the court relies on the Discovery Network case. And again, that's, you know, you could say that that case is on point, but that's a case where the government is banning a certain kind of handbill on newsstands. And the do not call list is not a ban. It's allowing consumers to opt out ahead of time. So it's more a question of saying it's my preference to be left alone. Now, the argument that
let me understand. You're saying that the difference here might be that the consumer is putting their own hand up voluntarily and specifying what they want to be shielded from.
Right. And the counter argument to that is, of course, well, then you need to give them the right to be shielded from everything at once. But I think that's not what Discovery Network deals with. It deals with the government saying, you know, commercial handbills will be banned from news racks in a particular city.
Anita Ramasastry, let me ask you, what about privacy rights here? We understand the right of free speech. It's big, well-known, and clear, but what about privacy? How does that stack up?
Well, privacy rights, again, the test that the court mentions that the government has to meet is whether or not they are, demonstrating that the restriction on commercial speech is going to directly and materially advance the interest. And there are two interests that are being espoused by the government here. One is the consumer's right to privacy, mm-hmm. The right to be left alone in their home. And the second is with respect to preventing potentially abusive or fraudulent types of calls by telemarketers.
But, of course, many people see the call itself as a kind of abusive event. Stand by. I want to begin to welcome our callers in. A lot of them want to join this conversation. Let's go to Todd in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Todd, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Good evening. What's on your mind?
Well, I was actually talking to your screener when Robert Bomash may have addressed my exact question, which is why can't we have a checkoff for commercial charities, politicals, and poll taking, et cetera. But now I hear your other guests are also broadening the list.
So you say let's just cover the whole waterfront here. Why restrict it to commercial calls? Make it cover everything? You don't want any calls.
No. I'm suggesting that we just simply have a checkoff, that you have a certain number of categories, and we just simply check off. No, I don't want this one.
I see a checklist.
And my second question is, if you feel they've already addressed that, my second question is, what can Congress do? What can we hammer Congress with our 50 million calls to say, please do, XYZ? What's the XYZ? What can we do?
Well, those are both great questions. Let me pick them up, and thanks for your call, Todd. Martin Reddish, first to you, what about this idea that you give the consumer a checklist where they can check off, I don't want commercial telemarketing, I do or don't want political fundraising, I do or don't want charitable calls? Would that satisfy the constitutional requirement?
It would certainly come closer. If you gave people an equal option to pick and choose that way, at the very least, you would be, in the court's phraseology, expanding their ability to decide for themselves what calls come in. I think it's important to note the court really didn't make the inference Anita suggests that if everything was included, this would be constitutional. They didn't have to face that issue, and I don't think they did. And unless and until Congress expands it to make it all-encompassing rather than under-inclusive, we really never have to face that privacy issue. The privacy issue really doesn't come up in this case because the calls left out invade privacy as much as the calls included.
So unless Congress doubles back and says everything is barred, you can put a do not disturb sign up for all calls or have a check off and check off any kind of call. Robert Bulmash, our caller from Green Bay, wants to know what he and the other, 50 million Americans who signed up for this can do to make sure that it happens somehow. Is there still a path, or is this just in the hands of the courts now and outside of that kind of public pressure?
Well, it's hard to pressure the courts. The courts rule as they see the law takes them. But really, what they can do right now, and as they could have done, and do for the last 10 years or more, is when they receive a call from a commercial organization trying to sell something, is say the following three statements, and this is pursuant to the Telephone Consumer Protection Act: put me on your do not call list, share my request with all affiliates, and send me a written copy of your do not call policy.
All firms must have a policy available upon demand and make it available when you make that.
Okay, that's great. But you know, most people's experience is that's like trying to fight the ocean back with a teaspoon. I mean, there's always another company to call you.
It's company specific. It's a slow and laborious way. Private Citizen notifies over 1,900 firms en masse and tells them, put us on your do not call list. So we take care of quite a few firms at one time.
So that's the personal thing that people can try and do. But what about at the public policy level here?
At the public policy level, contact your congressmen, your senators, and let them know that there needs to be this checkoff, which I think would most approximate constitutional law.
Anita Ramasastri, do you see Congress going for that if one of the checkboxes on there would have to be no political fundraising, please?
I'm not a politician, so I can't answer that. I mean, my answer as a consumer skeptic might be no. But back to this issue of privacy, the court is interpreting and saying that, you know, all calls, or not all calls, but charitable calls and telemarketing calls are equally invasive. And I think the issue here, and this is one that may be addressed on appeal, I'm trying to sort of present, you know, what might the FTC argue, is that there's a sort of qualitative issue, yes, unwanted calls are annoying, but there's a quantitative one. The record shows that theoretically there's will be a 40-60% reduction in telemarketing calls if the do not call list was implemented today. So one might be able to argue that, yes, actually the FTC and Congress were addressing the privacy concern on a quantitative basis by looking at the commercial actors.
Right.
In addressing this. And I think a broader issue, and Professor Reddish will say, we have a case that's on point, but there are other Supreme Court cases, Metro Media versus City of San Diego, which have said, yes, you can restrict the way in which, for example, commercial billboards are placed while still carving out exemptions for political, types of billboards.
Well, what a fascinating story. And I do note that this U.S. Appeals Court in Denver that refused today to block the anti-telemarketing measure said, and I'm not sure how that all fits into the picture here, it's at some point too much to follow, but they did note the level of popularity of this program. The court said, first, the public interest in respecting residential privacy weighs against a stay of the FCC's order. So the court's looking out from its chambers a little bit there. Michael's calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hello, everyone.
Hi, good evening.
Hey, in my drive, I've heard a lot. I'm on the road, and I've heard a lot regarding the current decision. And one thing I haven't heard anybody offering an opposing view.
An opposing view of what? Of the telemarketing industry, Michael?
Absolutely, yes, sir. I've been in the industry for a significant period of time, and it's very easy to be critical of anybody that happens to be in a sales role. I think we would all agree that in sales, there's always the opportunity for something underhanded or less than something that creates a less than delightful customer experience to occur. One of the gentlemen earlier had mentioned a situation with a lady that had put some bars on her window and had gone through some situations because she thought she was
getting crank calls. But you're in the business, and I see here you're a telemarketing supervisor. You oversee 700 telemarketers. That's a lot of calls go out of there. You don't see that as a nuisance?
Well, actually, to clarify a little bit, I'm not actually a telemarketing supervisor. I kind of run the operation. And actually, no, I really don't. I mean, what we really have to take a look at is the fact that it's just, for example, if you're out on the street corner, obviously we've all seen people standing on their soapbox on the street corner saying things that we might consider less than desirable. But just because you happen to be there, you're not required to stand there and listen. And everyone, the thing that keeps getting bannered around is the fact that, the catchphrase with this has been, well, we're tired of people calling during dinner. Well, I don't like that either, but the reality of the situation is that when someone calls you, the consumer has complete control. No one requires you to stay on the phone. No one requires you to listen to that individual.
But, Michael, shouldn't I have the right to keep you from bringing your soapbox into my, kitchen, dining room, bathroom in the first place?
Well, see, that's where I would absolutely disagree. No more than you have the right to tell an organization, hey, don't mail me something. Junk mail isn't any different than a telemarketing call, and the majority of Americans that receive telemarketing calls consider them junk calls, and I wouldn't disagree with that. And the great thing about the law, as I'm sure everyone on this phone is aware or on the radio is aware, one of the distinguished gentlemen that was talking earlier had mentioned something briefly about it. Every organization is required to maintain a do not call list, and the law provides a legal remedy for customers who feel like they've been abused.
Michael, your phone's getting thin on us, but let me ask you one thing. If the do not call list goes into operation, you're the boss man, what will happen to your 700 telemarketers?
Well, we're going to have to diversify. We do inbound and we do outbound. Inbound, of course, being when customers call us for questions or account maintenance or whatnot. And frankly, you know, it looks like we'll be in a situation where we're going to have to make some personnel decisions, which is unfortunate.
And 700 employees, you've got a pretty big operation. How are you calling this? Which way do you think it's going to break? Do you think the list will hold or be overruled by the courts?
Well, it's tough to argue with 50 million Americans. You want to respect the rights of individuals. But on the same note, you need to respect the rights of people to be able to do business. In my opinion, I think it's going to end up leaning in favor of the majority of consumers, which want to put it in place.
Michael, we've got it. We thank you very much for calling in. Anita Ramasastri, as you listen to that, how do you assess it? Michael's got a big operation. He's got 700 telemarketers, and he says it's no different than junk mail. Why are people so up in arms about it?
Well, I think there are differences. First of all, I mean, if you put a do not solicit or no solicitations or no solicitors on a sign and hang it on the outside of your house, that has to be respected because otherwise it's considered a trespass for someone to come onto your private property when you don't want to hear their message. And a telephone call is somewhere in between. So, you know, the inconvenience of picking up the phone and having to deal with someone not physically there but verbally there is, I think, a little different than junk mail where you get it and you toss it quite quickly and you collect your mail perhaps once a day, whereas the calls might keep coming. So I think, yes, you know, junk mail is one analogy, but the signs that you hang on your house barring solicitors is another one, and that's one where clearly that needs to be respected.
Robert Bulmash, clearly Americans respond quite differently to telemarketing calls than they do to junk mail.
It just comes down to one thing. The junk mail sits in our mailbox waiting for our convenient time to stop by. The junk phone call industry summons us to the phone with a ringing bell as if we were Pavlovian dogs with wallets, using our conditioned reaction to the summons of the telephone. And in back of it, the telenuisance and telemarketing industry knows that the most likely result of their summons of us away from caring for our elderly or our children will most likely serve nothing more than to disturb us. They know that what they're doing is an annoyance.
Because the percentage of sales they get out of those calls is low, you mean?
Sales can be as low as one out of 200, and they're still making a profit because of the minimal expense of making telemarketing calls.
Martin Reddish, let me put that to you. We've just got a minute here before the break, but you've represented these groups. You must also have had your dinner interrupted. How do you feel about it? Were you a conflicted attorney on this case?
Well, you know, when you do free speech work, it comes with the territory that sometimes you don't always agree with the people you're representing, and that's, and I'm not saying that's true here, but that's really beside the point. The one thing I would mention, we should emphasize, these aren't Halloween pranksters calling asking if your refrigerator is running. Maybe the percentage of sales isn't great, but market forces are at work here, and there must be people buying something, or else these people wouldn't have an economic incentive.
But if Robert's got it right and you're throwing away 99 calls and interrupting 99 meals to sell one, I don't know, Florida vacation, what's the ratio of public benefit there? Stand by. Robert Bulmash, Martin Reddish, Anita Ramasastri. We're talking tonight about the fate of the federal do not call list. You can join the conversation. Are you one of the 50 million Americans who have already signed up for the federal do not disturb sign? And is stopping the telemarketers suppressing free speech? Or is it saving your sanity? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the fate of the federal Do Not Call list and the future of telemarketing and the peace of your family dinner hour. My guests tonight from Seattle, Washington, Anita Ramasastri. She's assistant law professor at the University of Washington and associate director of the Scheidler Center for Law, Commerce, and Technology at the University of Washington. From Highland Park, Illinois, Martin Reddish. He's professor of law and public policy at Northwestern University and has stood up legally on behalf of telemarketing firms in this whole conversation and in the larger national debate. And Robert Bulmash joining us from Naperville, Illinois. He's president and founder of Private Citizen, a consumer advocacy advocacy group. You can join the conversation as well. Is the telemarketing problem really a nightmare, or is it overblown? Is it fair? Is it constitutional to clamp down on commercial speech and leave the phones open for political and charitable fundraising? And what do you think? Will Washington ultimately have the nerve to jettison the Do Not Call list when 50 million American households have signed up for it? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Barbara's calling from Maynard, Massachusetts. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm a teacher, and as a teacher, I'm a big proponent of our civil rights and free speech. However, I think that there is a major difference between, I take issue with what some of the callers have said, major difference between junk mail and telemarketing, mm-hmm. and even spam. Junk mail is paid for by the person that is sending the mail. I can look through my mail, decide that there's something that I don't want, toss it. It doesn't cost me anything. However, I pay for my phone service. I pay for my internet connection. I think it's a different situation. I think that I have the right to not be bothered by things that, you know, sales calls and things like that.
Because you're paying for the phone service, and so in a way you feel as though you own that service, mm-hmm. at least your instance of it, and so you ought to have more control over it. Let's examine that legally. I mean, it's an interesting point, Barbara.
If I have the choice, if there's a newspaper that I don't like what they're saying in the newspaper, I have the choice of not buying that paper, not reading it. If I'm listening to a radio station and I don't mm-hmm. like what the commentator is saying, I can change the channel.
But you own that phone. On the other hand, you in a sense own that phone service. Let us pick that up. Anita Ramasastri, how about it? Does it make any difference that Barbara and other Americans are paying for the telephone service that brings the telemarketing call in?
I would say that, I mean, with respect to spam, I think it's a little different because there you are sort of paying and you have a limited bandwidth and an inbox. So, I mean, I agree with Barbara on the point about just sort of what the level of intrusion. But with respect to the call itself, I mean, the price of initiating the call is something that's built into the general phone service. So
and still she kind of owns, she does pay to have this service. Does that not make, yes, the telemarketer is paying for the incoming call, but she's paying for the service. Does that not rank in here anyway?
I mean, I suppose it ranks in the sense of you're paying for infrastructure, but you also pay to construct a mailbox in your house,
yeah.
to receive mail. I mean, if you didn't want anything, you could certainly just say, I don't want to get any mail at all. So I think it's a harder analogy to make, whereas I think for spam, that is a true issue. There's more of an economic issue of actually having something clog your inbox.
But you can hear this citizen, and I'm sure others, and thanks for your call, Barbara, but saying, look, grasping for some way to say, I have the right to shut this off, to clamp down on this. Maury's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Maury. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Tom, I've been listening to the discussion and smiling because this has happened so many times before.
What exactly?
Well, the issue is so simply resolved. There's a sort of a misunderstanding of principle or an overlooking of a fundamental principle by
okay.
both sides that would resolve it so that no one needs to be hurt and everyone could be satisfied instead of we're looking for a one-size-fits-all solution here.
What's the magic key, Maury?
Well, the magic key is that Barbara glimpsed at the previous caller, the private property issue. She owns her phone. She did make a logical error, of course. I have. Can I make a side comment on that?
Make it quick.
I go straight to the point.
Well, yeah. Well, I guess it's more important to me to know what's your point. How do we fix this?
My point is that even I cannot imagine all the solutions, although I can think of a few that the free market would come up with. The phone company owns the transmission facilities. You own your phone. The telemarketers own their phones. I'm sure that of the 50 million people who don't want to be called, every single one of them, probably, chooses that because they probably are certain calls they would like to receive, but they don't want to pay the price of having to receive the others.
Right. Of course, now, you can't give up your phone service. So what's the alternative?
Course. Well, if you hear me out, there's a simple solution. You can do this when you fill out the phone company. I'm sure the telemarketers themselves don't want to waste time calling people who are not interested in their product. If this is not really a free speech issue but a property rights issue,
you're saying let the phone company somehow get in the middle here and give me a form to fill out, and they would then govern the traffic of calls to my house, to my phone?
What I'm saying is there's a demand for both. There are people who want calls. There is no one size fits all. There are people who want to receive all the calls. There are people who want to receive none of them.
So who's going to be the traffic cop, Maury? Who's going to get in the middle of that?
the telephone company, when people can register as telemarketers.
Yeah.
I'm just giving you one example.
It sounds like the solution that they're bringing up on the spam front, where they'd want a kind of sort of code in incoming spam. Martin Reddish, can you imagine that working somehow, that we just work it through the private channels, that the customer and the phone company come to some kind of agreement about, you know, what kind of incoming calls they'll accept and require telemarketing firms to register? Could that work?
Well, I don't speak for the telemarketing companies, but my guess is they'd say that wouldn't be satisfactory, because the people who say they don't want calls, the telemarketers would say, we want one bite at the apple, and we can convince them. And this takes away their one bite at the apple.
Mm-hmm.
So I would think that wouldn't make everybody happy. That would be my prediction.
Let me ask you also, Martin Reddish, on this issue of commercial speech versus free speech. We heard voices coming out of Washington today, including Congressman Ed Markey, saying that the Supreme Court has historically given much greater protection to political speech than to commercial speech, implicitly making the argument there that you could support a do not call list that blocked commercial but let political through. Do you see that possibility in the Supreme Court's precedent?
You know, that's yes and no is what I'd say. The court says commercial speech receives slightly, not significantly, less protection. But if you look inductively at what the court has done, I know Anita cited quite correctly the Metro Media case. That was many years ago. It's really a different world since about the time of Discovery Network in 93. Over the past 6 years, I can think of six major commercial speech cases, and in each one of them, the Supreme Court has held it unconstitutional. As a practical matter, there really isn't that much difference. And what Discovery Network says is, government cannot exclude from regulation speech solely because it is not commercial. And that is my position. The fact that somebody has a commercial motivation for his or her expression makes it no less valuable. The First Amendment is not the preserve of Mother Teresa. There are economic motivations for lots of expression, and I don't see why we pick out commercial providers and penalize them for their profit motivation.
Well, and so far, with the ruling out of Denver, that's where it stands, and we'll see where it goes. Peter's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi. From what I understand, it was not until 1898 that Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific gave corporations the same rights as individuals, as far as the First Amendment was concerned. I don't think this is a constitutional issue. I think this is an issue of jurisprudence. The 14th Amendment was initially intended to protect people of color from injustice and to forward their own claims. And Justice Hugo Black, writing in 1938, commented that the history of the 14th Amendment proves that the people were told that its purpose was to protect weak and helpless human beings, and were not told that it was intended to remove corporations from the control of state government.
So what are you suggesting, Peter? How do you think this is going to work out? Will the do not call list stand or not?
I'm suggesting that this particular issue is a straw man and standing in for a challenge by the citizenry to the rights of corporations as individuals.
So you're getting all the way back to the basics here and saying that there's enough anger about this that it could come back around to that kind of basic reconsideration. Anita Ramasastri, can you imagine it?
Well, there may be some broader kind of issue or latent issue here, but I think there are two different topics. The Santa Clara case is about whether corporations have rights, mm-hmm. but what's at issue here is commercial speech, and we could be talking about an individual who is engaging in commercial speech because they're a proprietor running a business, and perhaps they make lots and lots of direct marketing calls or hire people to do so. So it's not just about corporations. And so I think this is a distinct issue here, and it's about the scope of the First Amendment and the type of speech that can be protected and at one level.
Anita, we're almost out of time. I want to get a bottom line from you. Where do you think this is going to end up? Is 50 million Americans want relief. Are they going to get it or not?
I think they might be able to get it. I think one of the issues with respect to the court's opinion was that the court felt that the record below or the legislative history wasn't sufficient enough about issues like abusive practices and whether or not commercial telemarketing poses a specific harm to the consumer. And so that's one issue I think that needs to be looked at more closely.
But we're hearing tonight, right from the top of the program, that to everyone's surprise, this thing is really in trouble now. Despite all the people who have signed up for it, going to be a lot of attention on this in the courts and elsewhere. Anita Ramasastry, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Anita Ramasastry is at the University of Washington. She's assistant law professor there. And Martin Reddish, thanks very much for joining us from Highland Park.
Thank you.
Martin Reddish, professor of law and public policy at Northwestern University, and Robert Bullmash, president and founder of Private Citizen. Thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, former Polish President Lech Walesa calls for a new world order. This is On Point. The man who led Poland's struggle against communism is joining the growing chorus of international leaders calling for a revamping and strengthening of the United Nations. This week, Lech Walesa said he would like to see the UN serve as a, quote, global parliament. Walesa's remarks came in the United States after Tuesday's impassioned plea for reform by UN Secretary General Kofi Annan before the General Assembly. Here's an excerpt from Walesa's speech Wednesday, translated by an interpreter.
Since September 11th, we should make a choice.
Albo uzyskać poparcie Stanom Zjednoczonym w tych działaniu.
Either to obtain support for US efforts in this area.
Albo zmodyfikować ONZ.
Or to modify United Nations organization.
Na tamtym spotkaniu poprzednim ja mówiłem u was o tym.
I was talking about it during my previous talk here at Harvard.
Że mamy taką sytuację, że mamy supermocarstwo, bardzo operatywne.
I was talking about having one superpower which is very effective.
Ale bez przyzwolenia świata na działanie.
Różne. But without world support.
I ONZ, które ma przyzwolenie, ale biurokratycznie nie działa.
And on the other hand, we have United Nations, Organization of United Nations, with such support, but without any power, real power.
I wtedy proponowałem.
And my offer was,
zróbmy z ONZ-u parlament globalny.
Let's do a global parliament.
Z Rady Bezpieczeństwa rząd globalny.
Let's replace Security Council with global government.
Z NATO Ministerstwo Obrony Globalnej.
And NATO should be a defense ministry for entire world.
I oddajmy tematy niewygodne dla państw.
And let's give them all inconvenient problems which countries are struggling with.
Na dziś i wtedy były trzy tematy.
As for today, there were three subjects only.
Sprawy konfliktów granicznych.
Border conflicts between
ktokolwiek
countries.
Waży się na granicę kogokolwiek, siły globalne nauczą go porządku.
Whoever would try to change any border, global forces should take care of it.
Drugi temat to antysemityzm, rasizm, czystki etniczne.
Another subject is antisemitism and racist ideologies.
Ktokolwiek waży się w tym temacie robić nieszczęścia, siły globalnego natychmiast do porządku przywołają.
Whoever is doing something in that direction, global forces should fight it.
I trzeci to terroryzm. Terroryzm, trzeci
and
temat.
And the third subject is terrorism.
Globalnie bronimy wszędzie, gdziekolwiek się pojawia, musi być do końca wyjaśnione.
Let's use global forces to fight terrorism.
Nie ma się zlituj.
We shouldn't have any mercy against terrorists.
To należało zrobić w tym czasie.
It should be done already years ago.
To jest obowiązek supermocarstwa.
It's a superpower's duty.
Tylko Stany mogą to przeforsować.
Only the United States could do it.
Dlatego jest pytanie, czy Stany Zjednoczone chcą być supermocarstwem.
Therefore, there is a question whether United States wants to be a superpower.
Jak nie chcą, niech oddadzą to Polsce. My będziemy wiedzieć, co z tym zrobić.
If not, let's give it to Poland and we'll know what to do with it.
Former Polish President Lech Walesa speaking through a translator Wednesday night at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.